Thank you for joining our call today, CMS Lessons from the Frontlines on COVID-19. Today's topic is therapeutics. I'd like to turn it over to CMS Administrator Seema Verma. Administrator?
Thank you, Alina, and thank you all for joining our CMS Lessons from the Frontlines on COVID-19 call today. I'm the administrator, and I'd like to begin by thanking all of you for the work that you are doing day in and day out to care for patients around the nation. You really are the heroes on the front lines of this war, and our nation is grateful for everything that you are doing. We know that this has been extremely disruptive to the healthcare system, and we appreciate these sacrifices that you're making, like not performing elective surgeries and rapidly implementing telehealth. Today, CMS will announce that we are making accelerated payments to Medicare providers that may have cash flow issues. And tomorrow, or very soon, we plan to make additional announcements around a range of regulatory facilities to make your jobs during this unprecedented epidemic. So stay tuned. I speak for the President, the Vice President, the Task Force, FEMA, and our entire administration when I say we are here to support your frontline efforts, and we want to make sure that we keep an open dialogue with providers as well as facilitate conversations across the country so we can learn from one another about what works and to drive innovation in our response. Today's call is part of our ongoing series, CMS Lessons from the Frontlines on COVID-19. Our first call in this series took place earlier this week, and we were joined by Dr. Dua, who talked about testing, and then we also spent some time on telehealth. Since then, we've heard from many of you that you found this forum to be helpful as a learning network for best practices and information sharing. Around the nation, providers and local communities are innovating in response to COVID-19, and at CMS, our goal is to bring local innovators together to share best practices that can be scaled at the national level. Today, our discussion is going to focus on treatments, and we are joined by FDA Commissioner Dr. Hahn. But before that, Ambassador Dr. Birx is with us as well, and you all know who she is, and so I will turn it over to her to give a few comments, and then she will turn it over to Dr. Hahn. Thank you.
Thank you, Seema, and really, again, I just want to echo the administrator's incredible words of thanks to you all. I guess many of you don't know me, but I'm one to both thank and ask. So we are experiencing a different profile of admission than many of the other countries that have confronted this virus in the last few months. Certainly the average age in both admissions and the ones when going to the ICU were older in both China and Italy, because their population, particularly in Italy, is a decade older. So a lot of their recommendations come from working with a much older population in the hospitals. We're really looking to you all to provide us insights that we can share broadly across the nation as more metro areas become engaged in this epidemic, to really ensure that we're learning from you about the issues confronting particularly people under 55. The average age of the admission, I think many of you know, in Italy was over 62, and the average of the individuals who succumbed to the illnesses was in their mid to late 80s. So we need to really understand what you're seeing and how our patients will respond may be different than Italy and China, both from clinical care and what would be important related to therapeutics. So I just want to plea for your wisdom so that we can get that into a broader context as new cities confront what New York is seeing currently. So thank you for your work, and thank you for the information you'll be giving us to really help disseminate new findings, and particularly around people under 55.
And may I please ask everyone who has an unmuted line to mute their lines? We're hearing some background noise. Again, please mute your line if you are not speaking. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Birx and Administrator Verma. This is Steve Hahn, Commissioner of Food and Drugs. I want to echo what Deb just said. It was 3 short months ago that I was also a practicing physician, and I can only imagine what you are facing out there in this country. My many, many thanks. One of the wonderful things that our country has is doctors who are compassionate and skilled, and we all very much appreciate what you're doing on the front lines. One of the major returns I'd like to see from this call is input from you so that we can give that input to the task force as well as to our response through FEMA and Health and Human Services. Your input's critical so that we can adapt and adjust as needed to what's happening on the front lines in this very quickly moving situation. I just want to briefly talk about FDA's role here, what we do in these situations, and then turn it on to Dr. Anand Shah, who is Deputy Commissioner for Medical Products, to talk about some of the experimental therapies that we have available for patients across the country. So we're focused in two major areas. One is facilitating medical countermeasures to diagnose, treat, and prevent the disease, but also, very importantly, surveilling the medical product chain for potential shortages or disruptions in that supply chain. And we've all seen that those have occurred. We have anticipated that those occurred, and we have had an amazing response from manufacturers in the private sector as well as the public sector to try to fill the gaps that we're seeing in medical products. We've engaged across the government in this effort, and as you probably know, this information goes to HHS and to FEMA. And so for many of you, your local FEMA representatives are who your hospitals can contact with respect to questions about the supply chain, particularly around personal protective equipment and ventilators. We have been balancing the need to ensure safe and effective treatments and safe and effective medical products like personal protective equipment with reducing red tape so that we can move as quickly as possible. I want to give you a couple examples why I think this balance is really important. One is we last night approved a point-of-care test by Abbott Laboratories. They have an installed base in many of your offices, similar to the flu and strep test, and that is a five-minute test for a positive and a 13-minute test for a negative. So very rapid in-office test that should expand testing capacity. The CEO and I have spoken about this, and this is a situation, this is a test that normally takes them 9 to 10 months to develop. And they had collaborated very closely with the FDA, and this took between 4 and 6 weeks. So it really is an all of America approach to do this. The other thing I want to point out is that with respect to PPE, I know as a frontline provider, when I had to don an N95 mask, I was confident that that mask provided the protection that was necessary for both patient and provider. And we've seen unprecedented demand for these masks and other personal protective equipment. And what we want to make sure is if we allow into the country N95s, for example, that we have not looked at ourselves, that we are making sure that the labeling is appropriate so you understand what the best uses are for those personal protective equipment. And the folks at FDA are working around the clock in that area. The other big issue that's come up is hand sanitizer, and we are also working around the clock to expand that as well with the manufacturers. Compounding pharmacies now have guidance from us on how to make it. One thing I want to point out is that diversion of hand sanitizer is a major issue. If denatured alcohol is not used, so if conventional alcohol is used and it's not denatured, that is a hazard to toddlers. And we've seen diversion and 1 teaspoon of hand sanitizer that does not have denatured alcohol could kill a toddler. And so we're very cognizant of the fact, and we've been expanding the list of denaturants to try to get that into the community as quickly as possible. And the last thing I just want to mention from our perspective is the prevention of fraud. Many of you have heard the reports of some individuals who've taken over-the-counter chloroquine products that are used for cleaning fish tanks. We've made it clear that there are no over-the-counter chloroquine products that are approved by FDA or safe for use by anyone. getting that message out to your patients and to Americans is really important because, of course, taking that is potentially lethal. And my final word here is that we are expediting a broad range of therapeutics with manufacturers and developers. We hope to bring out into the medical community through clinical trials. And it's important to remember that there are no FDA-approved therapeutics at the moment for the treatment of COVID-19. So thank you again for all the terrific work you're doing. It's so impressive to see American medicine at work. I realize that the system is stressed, but thank you for what you're doing. And I'll hand it over to Dr. Shaw.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Han. Thank you, Administrator Verma. I'd like to start by discussing how we're accelerating the development availability of new treatments and vaccines. Currently, clinical management includes infection prevention and control measures and supportive care, including supplementary oxygen, mechanical vent support when indicated. That said, there are an array of drugs approved for other indications, as well as several investigational drugs that are being studied in several hundred clinical trials underway around the globe. As we move forward in the study and use of these products, it's essential that we understand and continue to develop the safety profile and understand the evidence associated with these drugs. For example, chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, these are being studied as potential treatments for COVID-19. We know the safety and effectiveness of these drugs for treating the diseases for which they were approved. What we don't know is how safe or effective these drugs are for treating COVID-19. Similarly, FDA has granted access to hundreds of patients to the investigational antiviral remdesivir. This drug has broad antiviral activity that inhibits viral replication, and we know that it has in vitro activity against SARS-CoV-2, and also in vitro and in vivo activity against related beta coronaviruses. Currently, there are four options for obtaining remdesivir for the treatment of hospitalized patients with COVID-19 and pneumonia in the United States. The first is an NIH-sponsored adaptive double-blinded placebo-controlled trial. There are two phase three randomized open-label trials. And in areas without clinical trials, COVID-19 patients in the United States have been treated with remdesivir on an uncontrolled compassionate use basis. Importantly, Gilead, the manufacturer, is currently transitioning the provision of emergency access to this drug from individual compassionate use requests to an expanded access program, and this is being done in tandem with FDA. Gilead and FDA will have more information available shortly on this expanded access program. Another promising treatment the FDA is taking the lead on is facilitating the development and use of therapies such as plasma from donors who have recovered from COVID-19, such as convalescent plasma, as well as hyperimmune globulin. These products use antibody-rich blood products that are made from blood donated by people who have recovered from the virus that can then be administered to individuals diagnosed with COVID-19. Both of these products have the potential to shorten the length or lessen the severity of illness. Even as we are heartened by the promise of some of these products, we also must be wary of and responsive to developments that bring unintended consequences to other patients. For example, we've seen a surge in the demand of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, which has led to an impact on patients who are dependent on these medications for the treatment of malaria, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis. We're doing everything possible to work closely with manufacturers to increase production. We're working with manufacturers to assess their supplies and are actively evaluating the market demand for the patients that are dependent on these medications. But as prescribers, please understand that this is a fluctuating and dynamic situation. Regarding these drugs, we've received several offers of donation from drug manufacturers for millions of chloroquine tablets. The FDA is working closely with these companies to ensure the quality and safety of the donated product. We're also in touch with companies on their efforts to accelerate production of chloroquine. For example, one manufacturer aims to increase chloroquine production by 25% over the next month. Companies are also working to produce millions of additional chloroquine tablets in coming months by importing more active pharmaceutical ingredient, or API, from abroad. and we're working to make sure that this can happen as expeditiously but also safely as possible. A few words on clinical trials. We're working with a number of companies to rapidly advance the development and availability of vaccines and treatments for COVID-19. There are many investigational COVID-19 vaccines and treatments that are being studied in clinical trials, but all of these are in early stages of development. FDA is working closely to ensure the safety and effectiveness of any products developed through these trials, and by facilitating expanded access to individual severely ill patients of clinicians without access to a clinical trial. On this point, I want to mention the challenge we face in terms of medical treatment of affected healthcare workers. Specifically, there are some questions regarding whether these frontline workers can have immediate access to drugs or whether they should be enrolled in clinical trials. And these are admittedly very complex and nuanced questions that we as an agency are working through with our provider community. A few words regarding supply chain. Another important aspect of our current focus at the agency is also vital to your work, making sure that Americans have access to safe and effective medical products, making sure that we're keeping a continual surveillance of the global supply chain to identify concerns and access or assess the availability of products that Americans need most. We are partnering very closely with FEMA, or the Federal Emergency Management Agency, on supply chain issues, including importation of necessary medical products. Let me give you a quick update on some of the details that we've taken there, and also on diagnostics. We don't, as an agency, develop tests, but we do engage with developers in the private and public sectors. We've accelerated the development of a number of COVID-19 tests and helped to rapidly increase the testing capacity in the United States. We've done this by providing maximum flexibility to labs as well as commercial manufacturers. FDA has authorized more than a dozen commercial tests, many of these at record speeds. We receive applications and oftentimes we're able to make a decision within days, including the point of care diagnostic that Dr. Han mentioned. This was approved last night and can provide results in less than an hour in a doctor's office. We're also working very closely with states to authorize certain laboratories within their jurisdictions to begin patient testing, and this is all without needing authorization from the FDA during the pandemic. We've granted that flexibility to New York, Nevada, and the state of Washington. We've also been researching and mitigating the shortages of laboratory testing components, including the identification and sharing knowledge regarding scientifically acceptable alternatives for testing components. We've put those on our website. We've established a mailbox and a toll-free number for quick responses to questions. That toll-free number is 888-INFO-FDA. We've also provided recommendations for test developers who may wish to develop serological tests during this outbreak. Serological tests measure the amount of antibodies or proteins present in the blood when the body is responding to a specific infection. We recognize that these tests are generally less complex than molecular tests, and they are solely used to identify antibodies. This limits their effectiveness for diagnosis. However, they can provide very useful information to providers and also to patients. We have taken a posture that we do not intend to object to the distribution or use of serology tests to identify antibodies where this test has been validated, where notification has been provided to the FDA, and when appropriate warning statements are included with these tests. I want to thank my colleagues from the FDA, Drs. Bernfrand and Drs. Murray, both of whom who are leaders in our division of antivirals, and also Dr. Nikolov, who is one of our leaders in the rheumatology branch. And with that, I want to turn it back over to Administrator Verma.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. And I believe, why don't we just take a few questions at this point and then before we move on to the next portion.
Operator, please open the line for questions. Thank you. Operator, please open the line for questions. Thank you very much.
Operator, question here.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Suraj Mahajan. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. Hi. So the lupus patients that need their Plaquenil that have been on it for years, just yesterday, three of our patients called saying they can't get it, from their regular pharmacies, whether it's Walgreens or and two of them actually are healthcare workers working in either hospital or nursing home setting. And so talk about the, double, triple whammy for these people who are going to front lines and are immunocompromised and don't have. So what can we do to get that refill? And these are not people getting new prescription that could be questionable. These are people who've been on years. So how can physicians ensure that people get those refills?
Doctor, thanks for your question. This is Anand Shah from FDA. We are continuing to watch that supply chain very closely. Just over the past 10 days, we've seen a surge in the number of pharmacy prescriptions for chloroquine, hydrochloroquine products. This is coming from a number of different avenues. One is an uptick in demand from the American consumer, from patients who want to have a dose ready and available on a prophylactic basis at home. We've also seen a surge and have been working with the medical licensing boards. We see a lot of self-prescribing from healthcare providers. That said, taken together, there is a run on the pharmacy, so to speak, for these products. We're working with the manufacturers, who produce these drugs both domestically and overseas to make sure that that supply is replenished and available for patients who need it for chronic disease management like your patients. So, we're watching this closely, and we are engaged multiple times a day with manufacturers. We hope that that supply should be smoothed out in the next few days.
Thank you.
Operator, we'll take our next question, please. Thank you.
Alina, if we don't have questions, we can move to the next section.
Operator, do we have any questions lined up in the queue?
Hello?
Okay, why don't we move along? We also have a section here that we're going to talk about experimental drug therapies. We have a presentation from Dr. Khalil and Dr. Mehta. They're going to be talking about the NIH remdesivir clinical trial. Dr. Khalil, Dr. Mehta, are you ready?
Dr. Khalil is going to join in 10 minutes.
Administrator Verma, perhaps we turn it to Dr. Debbie Bernkrant at FDA to share some updates on the experimental drug therapies.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting us to participate. My comments actually add to what Dr. Shah and Dr. Han had addressed. So given the significant impact of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, there is great interest, obviously, in developing new therapies or repurposing existing therapies to treat and prevent COVID-19. However, as was said, no drugs have yet been shown to be safe and effective against this or any coronavirus disease. Furthermore, because of the variable and complex nature of the disease and of proposed therapies, in many instances, it's difficult to predict whether an intervention could actually be harmful rather than helpful, even if there's biologically appealing rationale for its use. We are committed to supporting all scientifically sound approaches to attenuating the clinical impact of COVID-19. And we believe there's a shared priority among patients, clinicians, and public health decision makers, including regulators, to have the best information possible to guide treatment and minimize harm from therapeutic interventions. So it's essential that we get key information to be able to provide advice and guidance to ensure the safe and effective therapeutic interventions can be developed for those in need. How do we at the review division do this during a pandemic? Well, we not only provide advice on drug development and clinical trial design, but we review data to be able to make a determination whether the benefits of the use of the investigational drugs, as well as repurposed therapeutics for COVID-19, outweigh the risk. For investigational therapeutics, we would minimally like to see in vitro data with related viruses or the SARS-CoV-2 virus before trials are initiated in human patients. In addition, we would like to see animal model data with related viruses or with the current virus causing this outbreak. However, these are not rigid requirements, and we are open to discussion of the rationale for introducing candidate interventions into human trials. Well, what else do we need to see? Any available toxicology data to have an idea of what to monitor in the clinic. And any available data from previous human experience with the proposed therapeutic. Also, we would like to see a justification why the purported mechanism of action and dose would be appropriate to evaluate in patients with COVID-19. I also wanted to let you know that we have a special pre-IND program where we will rapidly review your proposal and questions to enhance the efficiency of interactions with us and any preparations you need before you submit a protocol under an IND that would actually initiate a clinical trial after our review. What are we looking for? We're looking for pilot trials to begin with that are randomized and placebo-controlled. Compared to single-arm trials, which may be intrinsically unable to differentiate either beneficial or detrimental drug effects from the variable and complex natural course of the disease, the pilot trials will provide more interpretable data on exploratory endpoints and safety and mortality before exposing larger numbers of patients to investigational therapeutics in later-stage randomized trials. Well-designed randomized controlled trials are the highest priority to guide improvements in patient care for the sake of everyone involved in this rapidly evolving situation. But we're also open to discuss different mechanisms for additional access, if needed, for patients who are unable to participate in clinical trials. We have a newly formed multidisciplinary Office of New Drugs team that manages all incoming COVID-19 drug development inquiries, and their email address is covid19-productdevelopment@fda.hhs.gov. In sum, I would like to say that we are patient advocates at the FDA foremost, and we are committed to supporting all scientifically sound approaches to attenuating the clinical impact of COVID-19. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bernkrantz. Do we have our operator on the line to help us open for any questions, please?
I have a question.
Sure. Happy to take your question. Hello? Hello, we can hear you. Oh, you can hear me. Oh, wow. Okay. My name is Dr. Toroff. I am double licensed in Ohio and Michigan. I live on the border. And there are a lot of us primary care doctors on private practice that we're ready to fight and help decrease the flow to urgent cares and ERs, but we have no PPE and we don't have the funds to even get the ones that are available that are at very high prices. And places like Molina are claiming that they're not even going to pay any doctors until after April 15th, if not later. So it's kind of hard for me to keep my doors open, but also try to fight on the front line without the funds or the access to the PPE.
This is Seema Verma. So a couple of suggestions there. Number one, you know, I know that a lot of providers are concerned about payroll, just you're not seeing patients, or some of your staff may be at home taking care of kids and not being able to help have the clinic be at full capacity. So one of the things that we announced at the beginning of the call is that CMS is making accelerated payments for Medicare, so that'll be based on your historical spend. You're welcome to go on our website to find some more information on that. In terms of PPE, we've been hearing a lot about that. The best thing to do is to talk to your local officials. There is a distribution channel where in which FEMA is distributing supplies, but they go to the state, and then the state's responsible for distributing those supplies. So if that's a concern,
right,
the best place is to go to your local health officials.
They're not sending it to anybody but hospitals still.
Okay, we can look into that, but I think that they're okay. Sort of in control of where these supplies go. So we'll continue to take a look at that, but I think then trying to communicate with the hospital about what your role could be and those local health officials.
And Administrator Verma, this is Steve Hahn jumping in. I think that's really good feedback, and we'll, as Administrator Verma said, we'll provide that feedback to the folks at FEMA. Regarding that request, maybe there's some communication we can give. I'm sure they're prioritizing where they're giving the PPE, but it's a really good thought and suggestion.
Thank you. Operator, do we have other questions lined up in the queue, please?
Okay, I think we're also going to hear from Dr. Murray from the FDA as well. He's the Deputy Director of the Division of Antiviral Products. Dr. Murray?
Hello, this is Jeff Murray. So we have numerous clinical trials up and running for some antivirals and immunomodulator drugs. And, I just wanted to make a statement that I think we need to manage our expectations regarding the therapeutic field because largely what's being studied are repurposed drugs, including the antivirals and immunomodulators. And the track record for repurposed drugs has been plus or minus. It's best if you have rationally designed agents against, for specifically for antivirals against a specific target. But in the past, and both Deb Burkert and I have been working in the antiviral field since early on in the HIV epidemic, a good example is AZT was repurposed, first drug for HIV approved, and it did work, but it wasn't, optimal. And, another good thing from that example is a randomized controlled trial was done even at that time of great need and showed a more mortality benefit at the same time that we were having expanded access programs. So, that's what we're trying to do now. Also, as far as managing expectations, as far as antivirals, there's not really a good track record for treating hospitalized critically ill patients with antivirals. We really don't have one approved even for influenza for that. And it may be better early on in disease seems to work well. So it'd be great to have, oral drugs for that. And that's where the hydroxychloroquine studies, may take a role. But maybe the greatest need for therapeutics could be for the immune response to treat things like cytokine release syndrome. And there are some trials up and running for that. Some of the IL-6 blockers, there's at least three trials, and you can find two of those trials up on clinicaltrials.gov. So we're very hopeful that maybe some of the immunomodulating products could work. But again, those are sometimes a little bit scary to think about some of them because we don't yet know if they could be harmful or helpful. We all know that the immunologic cascade can go either way and sometimes have paradoxical responses depending on dose. And so that's why we are strongly encouraging for these immunomodulators, randomized controlled trials before even really thinking about just giving them to individual patients. Because if we don't have those set up, basically, you might be giving just leaking out something harmful to people without ever having a chance of getting the result. So that's been our approach, and we've been trying to strike a balance between the randomized clinical trials and expanded access, as we had a long history of doing back decades ago with HIV. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? We want to open up the lineup for questions.
Yes, we have next question from Dheeraj Mahajan. Your line is now open.
Hi, it's Raj Mahajan again. Sorry, this question was not related to the drug, so I can wait till the end of the call. It's more about nursing homes and referrals with positive cases.
Operator, are there any more questions?
The next question comes from the line of Gary Leroy. Your line is now open.
Oh, okay, this is Gary Leroy from Dayton, Ohio, and I was actually not asking a question, but just responding to one of the previous callers about whether we're trying to get the PPEs for the county health departments as opposed to just the hospital, because they are doing collections. They are doing collections for some of these devices and things from various sources, and they're sending them to collection entities. And so possibly they could get this these PPEs to the physicians' offices and where they're most needed, without sending them to the hospital. Has anybody heard anything about that?
You know, this is Seema Verma. I think it varies in every single community. I mean, just to kind of give you a sense of the way it's supposed to work is that locally executed, state managed, and federally supported. So FEMA's sending materials to the state level, and then it goes to the local level. But it may vary in your particular community. I think per Dr. Hahn's suggestion, we can follow up with FEMA and in your state, Ohio, and just kind of flag that that's still an issue for those of you on the ground not knowing exactly where to go for supplies. But I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, and Detroit, Michigan, which is one of the hot spots, that's where I am.
Thank you. We will do that. Appreciate you flagging that.
This is Anand Shah from FDA. Just to add on to the administrator's comment, we're in direct contact with the governor and lieutenant governor in Ohio, specifically on PPE. So I know the state is working very actively to make sure that PPE gets directly into the doctor's offices.
Next question, please.
And your next question comes from the line of Robert Frericks. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I'm in Reno, Nevada, and I've been doing studies in metabolism to try to understand the metabolic basis of chronic disease. I do believe that some of that work has led to an understanding of how vitamin D regulates its effects on the immune system, and have a thought on a medication that may be quite useful that's been around for a long time but is not currently available. I don't want to say what it is, because I don't want to create a hydroxychloroquine type response to this. But I do want to engage, and I've sent emails to Fauci and Francis Collins, and of course I'm not getting any feedback. But I would like to discuss the potential for using a very safe drug as a clinical trial, and I'm not in the position to do clinical trials. So I would like to have a contact.
This is Commissioner Hahn. We'll give the contact information at the end of the call, so that you can either call or use our website. Really appreciate the suggestions. As you can imagine, we're getting quite a few, and we're looking at these certainly with a scientific and medical eye. But we welcome all opportunities to look at those things, Doctor. And at the end of the call, we'll give the contact information.
where I'll be able to personally talk to somebody because my attempts to contact have not gone through. I just get back form letters, basically.
Yeah, well, there's a long line of people bringing information to us. If you call in at the 1-888 number, which we'll give at the end, you will actually talk to a human being, and they triage the call to the appropriate place.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Ray Lorenzoni. You may ask your question.
Hi, this is Ray Lorenzoni from New York City. I had a question about, in comparison to HIV, where we kind of decreased our statistical sensitivity for a lot of the randomized controlled trials, is there a talk about decreasing our p-value to 0.1 instead of the typical 0.05 in order to create, explore cures and save lives more quickly? Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of...
Oh.
We need to respond. Dr. Hahn, do you want to respond to that before we take the next question?
Yeah, for sure. I was going to ask either Dr. Murray or Dr. Bernkrant to speak to what we do at FDA with respect to clinical trial design, which I think this question is related to.
Yeah,
I can start it off. Oh, go ahead,
okay.
Jeff.
Well, I think we're very flexible with p-values. I mean, I'm not going to give you the necessarily exact cutoff. It really depends on the study. I don't think that we would necessarily call a study failed because it exceeded 0.05 if all the rest of the data and some other supportive data show it's things going in the right direction and multiple endpoints going in the right direction. So I think, you know, in the setting of this pandemic, we are very going to be very flexible in, you know, the interpretation of some of these trials because we know that they can be difficult to enroll, and, you know, it's hard to choose a priori right now what the best endpoint would be for the statistical analysis. So I think we take that into account, and we'll be very flexible.
I think also, this is Debbie Bernkrant, this is why we're asking for a more rigorous pilot study to begin with, because we're asking for placebo-controlled trials up front. So at least we have a better chance to hopefully getting interpretable data, although limited, that will help to plan the larger clinical trials. And as Jeff mentioned, we're very flexible. We don't necessarily know the right endpoints at this point in time either. So we're looking forward to actually getting some data so we can be able to review those results and possibly learn something that we could pass on to the next clinical trial that comes in for review.
Next question, please, operator.
And your next question comes from the line of Chris Fitch. You may ask your question.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can, thank you.
Hi, this is Chris Pitch. I'm a geriatrician in Philadelphia. It's along the same lines of the questions that you've been getting regarding PPE, specifically about the N95. Right now for getting a supply of N95s, we're having difficulties, but we're able to get equivalent N95s from other countries, like the KF94, the KN95. Is there any comment about using those?
Yes, this is Steve Hahn from FDA. We've issued broad guidance around this as most recently as yesterday, and certainly have flexibility around those, in particular the K95 that you've brought up. If there's a specific brand or specific company, you all can go to our website or that 1-888 number that I'm going to give out. You can call as well with specific questions around those. If they aren't an FDA certified producer. In other words, we haven't inspected their plant, et cetera. We're just asking you to make sure that you verify that the sort of chain of custody, et cetera, the certification is appropriate. And just one last thing, not to get too technical. If any of these products have a CE certification, doctor, that is a good to go from our perspective.
And just let me shout out real quick the number here. It's 1-888-INFO, I-N-F-O-F-D-A, 1-888-INFO-FDA, and that's manned 24/7.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your question. We'll take one more question in this segment. And again, there will be plenty of time for Q&A later on in the call. Operator, next question, please.
Yes, we have next question from Mark Sherman. Your line is now open. Mark Sherman, you may ask your question.
Hi, Mark Sherman from Chicago. A question regarding hydroxychloroquine. Is there, do you envision any current indication for treating high-risk ALF patients with hydroxychloroquine with or without azithromycin? Or do you recommend against it?
Well, hi, this is Debbie Bernstein.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll start off this time. It's not that we're making a recommendation either way. The recommendation is for clinical trials, and we can refer you to clinicaltrials.gov, where the University of Minnesota has an interesting internet-based clinical trial looking at hydroxychloroquine for PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, as well as treatment. We've seen other clinical trials for PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. So I personally would recommend that you go onto clinicaltrials.gov and see the landscape of clinical trials that are being conducted with hydroxychloroquine. Jeff, anything else?
Yeah, I mean, we know a lot of doctors are using the hydroxychloroquine kind of routinely or perhaps chloroquine. One consideration with the azithromycin, we don't really see necessarily a lot of rationale, certainly in vitro data to support the azithromycin component. And one thing that we're concerned about as an outpatient for that combination is the potential prolongation of QT interval. In the hospital, that can be monitored better, but as an outpatient, that could be a potential toxicity that couldn't be monitored as well, since both drugs have the potential to prolong the QT interval. The chloroquine's more than azithromycin, but together it's kind of unclear, if that would be a worse combination for that safety risk. So we'd heard from some of the physicians, critical care physicians, that they were not using the combination anymore because they had too high a proportion of patients with unacceptably prolonged QT intervals. So that's just one caution for that combination.
Go ahead.
This is Andre Khalil. Just to let you know, I'm logged in for the talk.
Thank you. And just in follow-up to what Dr. Mary and Dr. Bernkrant just said, this is Steve Hahn, FDA. CDC has issued on their website, that was last weekend, a state of knowledge paper for physicians, for providers, regarding some of the questions that are being asked around hydroxychloroquine in particular. And so much of what Drs. Mary and Bernkrant said is stated in that document, but it's an easy and pretty handy document. I just refer you to that if you have questions about the drugs.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we are ready to talk about our NIH remdesivir clinical trial, and that will be a joint presentation from Dr. Khalil and Dr. Mehta.
Hi, this is Andre Khalil. I'll give you a summary of the trial and a little bit of about what we are doing here in Omaha, Nebraska. So the trial is an adaptive randomized trial in which, as you know, we started with remdesivir, and the goal here is to move with adaptations to other therapies throughout the process of conducting a trial. We start with the first patient here at the University of Nebraska, and now we have over 100 patients, getting closer to 100 patients pretty soon. And so the goal is to reach about 400 patients, around 440 patients, to complete the trial. And the prediction is that Probably in the next few weeks, the trial will be completed based on the enrollment rate that we've had, speeding up almost every day following the outbreak in the last week or so. The trial is, is a double-blind randomized trial in which, all my patients and myself and my coordinators and nobody else knows exactly what the patient's receiving. So frequently I get questions about, if we know about any progress. And the first scenery analysis, it's going to be done probably very soon in the next few days or next probably this coming week, that's going to be critical for us to understand the how to proceed with the trial. But this is something that is right now being evaluated because we need the full follow-ups of all the first 100 patients before the DSMB make the evaluation and the decision to proceed ahead. The trial is definitely running much faster than when we started. We have about 40 PIs here in the United States. We have sites in Singapore and South Korea as well. And so the idea is to try to really have as many sites as possible within the context of the trial and trying to complete the trial also in an efficient and safe way. I think that's important, I think, for the, for the listeners to understand too the how we have approached here at the University of Nebraska, the general approach to these patients other than the trial. As you know, the trial only enrolls moderate to severely ill patients, so these patients have to have not only the presence of the infection, but also pneumonia from COVID-19, from the SARS-CoV-2. That's about 20% or so, 15-20% of the patients. Most of the patients will not fit the criteria of the trial because the trial really requires that kind of severity. We've had many patients also that were severe but did not did not fulfill the criteria for the trial, or because they had renal failure, or because they had liver function test elevation, or they we couldn't consent for different reasons. The way we have approached all these patients is supportive care. We decide that would be a safety issue to give hydroxychloroquine or azithromycin. A lot of these patients already have chronic cardiac disease. They also, we've had patients with myocarditis from COVID and hepatitis from COVID. So these are all potentially side effects that can be really serious in these patients. So based on what you know from chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, and that has, these drugs have failed in every outbreak for the last 20 years against any virus. Literally every outbreak, people start with chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, and the story is really very poor track record. And then you add the safety issues, especially cardiotoxicity and liver toxicity. At University of Nebraska, we decide to completely avoid the drugs because we don't believe it's safe to our patients. And by the way, we've had patients come in after a week taking these drugs and getting very severely ill as well, both from COVID or side effects. So we unless these drugs are going to be tested in a clinical trial, we are not going to be advising any of our clinicians or patients to take this medication. So basically, we are in the trial, and whoever is not in the trial is getting the best supportive care. That's kind of in a quick summary of the situation in Omaha.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Anish Mehta. I'm an infectious disease physician at Emory University Hospital and the site PI for the NIH adaptive clinical trial that Dr. Khalil just mentioned here at Emory. I'm also a faculty member of the ASPR-funded National Emerging Infections Training and Education Center, NETEC. And I just want to echo a lot of what Dr. Khalil has just mentioned. We are strong believers in examining the correct methods of taking care of patients with COVID-19 through well-developed clinical trials. I will just start by saying Dr. Khalil has written a very nice editorial in JAMA recently, and I would refer people to this document as a really good rationale for why we need to examine scientifically what we're doing prospectively so that we can take care of our patients without causing harm. So here at Emory, we are managing, here at my hospital, almost 45 patients with COVID disease, and throughout our system, close to 140. We have several severely ill patients and moderately ill patients. We have been approaching all of these for clinical trials. We have not only the NIH adaptive trial, but we have another clinical trial for an IL-6 receptor blockade that's also placebo-controlled. And we strongly, again, believe that's the method to figuring out the right countermeasures for our patients. But I will also comment that we've taken care of dozens of patients that have not been receiving any medical countermeasures, but have been receiving very good supportive care, whether that be on our medical floors or in our ICUs, and we have been able to successfully treat them and get them out of the hospital. We have had patients that have been on the clinical trial and have been ventilated and proned and got them out of it and got them home. We've also had patients not on the clinical trials that have been proned and ventilated for several days and got them home. So I think it is that we are learning a lot from these experiences. And again, I think the clinical trials will give us the answers. I will also mention we have apprehensions about hydroxychloroquine as a general countermeasure, as Dr. Cleo has mentioned. I can tell you personally, I've had two patients who've come in the hospital who have been on hydroxychloroquine. And again, that's just two patient experiences. But one had been on it chronically for rheumatoid arthritis and developed COVID-19, ended up in the ICU, and is now better. We have had patients on prophylaxis that have with hydroxychloroquine that have developed COVID-19 as well. So again, this just underscores the reason to do good examinations, good clinical trials, to figure out the right ways to approach these patients, whether it be for treatment or for prophylaxis. And I would encourage everyone to participate in some sort of study to get these done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Administrator Verma, this is Steve Hahn. Can I jump in?
Please.
I just want to congratulate both of you for the terrific work that you're doing. FDA depends upon this sort of data being collected in a rigorous way to make decisions about safety and efficacy. And the message we just heard from our colleagues on the phone here, I think are really important for practitioners to communicate to their patients that, you know, we don't have any FDA-approved countermeasures for COVID-19. We have terrific folks around the country gathering data to try to help us figure that out. But there are dangers associated with therapies, and that has to be a doctor-patient decision. And just really strongly encourage the work that we just heard being done in Chicago and Nebraska. And thank you both for your terrific efforts.
Chicago, I am not doing any work.
Okay, well, with that, do we want to open it up for questions?
Again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone. And we have a question from Patas Romanian. Your line is now open.
Good morning. This has been very interesting, and thank you. I have a question. Are we using data from EHRs? Because I know I'm a hem-onc from Anchorage, Alaska. And the reason I ask is we have several EHRs, like CancerLink and Flatiron, where we're supposed to collect data that will help us hopefully treat patients in real time from experiences from other patients. So are we using our EHRs to collect data and see how patients are doing, say, either in Italy or New York? I'm concerned about our patients with cancer who are already receiving immunotherapy. And if they develop COVID, do we continue with the immunotherapy, and how do they respond? Do we have data on that?
This is Steve Hahn from FDA. I can speak to the first issue. I know of no data with respect to the immunotherapies, and, of course, being a cancer doc, I likewise have similar concerns. We are partnering with EHR companies and also university systems to try to obtain some of the real-world evidence that you're talking about. The infrastructure for that isn't as robust as it could be, but we're rapidly gaining experience with that and trying to help inform our decisions on the task force. So it's a really great suggestion that you've made, and it's an ongoing project.
This is Andre Khalil. If you allow me to just add to a response to your question, is that the electronic records are going to be, you know, they're going to be very important for us to understand the natural history of the disease and a little in the natural history of different hosts, like patients with different, you know, different situations, like patients that are immunocompromised from either, you know, cancer or from transplant. But the electronic records are not going to help us to understand what works and what does not work. So they are really useless for efficacy. They may help us a little bit for safety. Let's say if you have more patients with QT prolongation, cardiac arrest from chloroquine, azithromycin, that's going to be important, and that can be actually something that can be seen in electronic records. So the this kind of electronic record cohort can be very useful for safety, can be very useful for natural history, but unfortunately, it cannot help us in terms of efficacy. So just trying to understand the strengths and limitations of the electronic records. Over.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
And your next question comes from the line of Kevin Ohayek. Your line is now open.
Yes, my name is Kevin Ohayek. I'm a surgeon in the Cleveland area, and I think some of the data has definitely been shifted towards some of the medical frontline folks in terms of therapies for healthcare workers, things of that nature. Has there been any discussion about the operating room and potentially some prophylactic measures for the OR staff and surgeons and patients for potentially COVID positive or even patients that are asymptomatic?
This is Andre Khalil. I can tell on our experience in Omaha here in Nebraska, we take all the precautions that are needed to, you know, be taken in terms of quarantine and PPEs. But I just want to remind you there are absolutely no treatments for COVID. There are not only no proven treatments, no safe treatments. And I truly believe that in some places people are using either hydroxychloroquine or azithromycin preventive. I truly believe this is way more risky than beneficial because these drugs have very poor activity against any of these viruses and they have a lot of side effects. And if you're going to start to prophylax everyone with these drugs, we're going to harm people. So we literally have nothing at this point, and we cannot you cannot really start to do prophylaxis on the basis of what potentially can do or not, because I really think that we're going to be misleading ourselves with these drugs that healthcare providers are going to be protected or are going to be safer, while the only thing that we know that can really protect them is PPEs and quarantines, and make sure that we know exactly what's the situation with each patient. So we are not giving any kind of prophylaxis in terms of medications to any of our healthcare providers here in Omaha.
Just a quick follow-up. I think there have been also a lot of recommendations and guidelines of varying types for testing patients preoperatively before undergoing aerosolizing procedures, intubations, various laparoscopic procedures. But there's really, we don't really have that much guidance on the patients who, again, are asymptomatic, potentially have a cancer diagnosis that can't wait for 3 months for proceeding with surgery. I think some federal guidance may be helpful to decide, you know, when we could potentially do some preoperative, testing on patients to potentially increase our PPE, what we wear during the operations.
That's a great recommendation. We will take that back to CDC and our other partners at HHS, but appreciate that suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you.
And your next question? Mm-hmm. Your next question comes from the line of Chris Peterson. You may ask your question.
Yes, good afternoon. I joined the conversation a little late, but I'm curious as to if there's any thought of pursuing the drug Avagan, which is the Japanese anti-influenza drug. It apparently showed some promise and some use, I think, in China, and I just haven't heard of any ongoing interest in doing some trials regarding that medication.
Well, this is Andre Khalil. I can tell a little bit about, this favipiravir has also been given to patients with Ebola, and we don't have really any substantial results because there were no controls. The only study published with favipiravir that I'm aware of, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, because you know anything can be published a minute ago in today's situation. But the one that has been in the media, it's just a retrospective, it's a very small cohort in which they literally just compared favipiravir with lopinavir, ritonavir. There was no controls. There's no really any kind of a clinical or survival data that was meaningful. So basically, it's basically a case series, to be honest with you. We just don't have any data on favipiravir. I mean, I think I think that it's a drug that has in vitro activity as a lot of other drugs,
right.
But I'm not aware of clinical data in COVID. So I think if we have more clinical data on COVID-19, it's a drug that potentially can be part of a clinical trial. But I'm waiting to see more clinical data. I really didn't see any other than that very small case series. Over.
I would just say mechanistically, it seems to make more sense. Mechanistically, it seems to make more sense than hydroxychloroquine to my way of thinking, as being both a pharmacist and a physician.
This is Anish Mehta from Emory University. It is a direct-acting antiviral agent, so I would agree with you, has probably better theoretical potential than something like hydroxychloroquine. But this underscores what Dr. Khalil said. We need good preliminary data so that we could potentially include this in the NIH adaptive clinical trial. As Dr. Khalil had mentioned before, the adaptive clinical trial, once the first 440 patients are enrolled, will analyze which arm is superior, and the inferior arm will go away, and then one or two more arms will come in, and we will look at all potential countermeasures that could be included, including combination countermeasures. But to get to the point to include them in a second phase, we need good preliminary data. And so I would encourage those who are thinking about developing clinical trials to really formulate good, controlled, randomized clinical trials, even if it's a pilot study, so that data could be used then to inform these larger adaptive clinical trials so that we can get these agents analyzed in a prospective, comparative manner. Over.
Hi, this is Debbie Bernkran. I think this also points to the fact that sometimes in vitro data and animal model data don't always translate into efficacy in human clinical trials. So that's something else to keep in mind. But it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be further evaluated, at least preclinically in an animal model to start off.
Thank you. Next question, please.
And your next question comes from the line of Thad Waits. You may ask your question.
Yes, this is Thad Waits. I'm representing American College of Cardiology. And of interest to everyone, we would be having our annual session at this moment in Chicago with more than 20,000 people. We canceled it, of course. But we're doing it today virtually, and it's proving to be a huge success. Within the College of Cardiology, we have a listserv, and they're circulating about what to do about the thrombosis that's going on with COVID-19. it originated from New Orleans, where they're seeing young people who are having thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, and so forth. So far, in the multiple messaging back, nobody really has any experience or any suggestion of how to handle this, and I was wondering if anyone in this audience could help with that.
So this is Anish Mehta from Emory University. We are also concerned about the potential prothrombotic potential of a COVID-19 infection, and we have seen a few clots have developed in our patients. For our inpatients, we are giving them DVT prophylaxis and trying to ambulate them as early as possible, but also giving them guidance when they go home to watch out for symptoms of both DVTs and PEs and to report back to us if they're having any of those symptoms. We've also educated our ED providers to know about this risk so that they can evaluate patients with suspected or confirmed COVID-19 coming in with sudden onset shortness of breath for PEs as well. So I think the educational component will help us recognize these early and get patients treated early and diminish the ramifications of an acute PE and DVT. Over.
We had a webinar with a Chinese cardiologist, and there was at least some suggestion that D-dimer could be associated with the risk of antithrombosis or a marker for it, maybe. Any comment on that from anyone?
Again, this is Anish from Emory. We are monitoring D-dimers. I will say many of our patients do have elevated D-dimers during the acute phase of illness, but we are monitoring those. We have not had enough data to correlate a D-dimer level, either in mild, moderate, or severe disease with a risk for DVTs yet, but the data is still quite early. But that goes to the point of collecting the data on these patients so that we can understand what their risks are moving forward.
Thank you. I'm a fellow Emory grad.
It's always good to hear from someone from Emory. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
The next question comes from the line of Daniel Duggy. Please ask your question.
My question centers on the DVT and pulmonary emboli. There is a clinician who put out some information from New Orleans saying that they were not treating for DVT or pulmonary embolism, primarily because most of their really critically ill patients had thrombocytopenia and also elevated liver enzymes and probably also had acute renal failure. So the question is, if you're using prophylaxis, are you using very low-dose Lovenox? Are you using Eliquis? What are you using?
This is Anish Mehta from Emory University. We are using our standard protocols, so depending on the risk factors, dictates what modality of DVT prophylaxis we're using, whether that be SCDs versus Lovenox versus other agents. And then as far as treatment goes and what treatment we use for these thromboses, that is made on a case-by-case decision.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take one final question in this segment, please, and then we'll move forward with our agenda. Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Willie Underwood. Your line is now open.
Yes, how are you doing? This is Dr. Willie Underwood. I also do a lot of population health things in clinical trials. So we know previously that we've been unable to accrue a diverse population of patients in clinical trials. Is there anything that we're doing specifically here to assure that we bring in health systems that may or may not do clinical trials, but have a diverse population of patients who have been infected with COVID-19?
Hi, this is Andre Khalil from University of Nebraska, Omaha. So very good question. You know, as you realize, this is a very difficult situation in which we are literally just trying to offer the trial in all the areas that are most needed in the country, and so it's you know in part the site selection has been influenced by the need in different regional areas in the United States, and so it's its diversity, it's something that hopefully it's going to be part of the whole process, but it's not something that like in a regular elective planned with time randomized trial in which you're going to try to really understand the diverse population. This is we just didn't have time to really get into what normally you do with a more kind of a slow pace randomized trial. This is a fast pace. We had to design and get up and running in a matter of weeks and days. So it's a very important question, but how diverse a population you're going to get is going to depend on where you're going to enroll. At this point, you're enrolling patients pretty much in every corner of the country. So I hope that we'll have a well representative population of the whole country.
And just to add to what Dr. Khalil said, this is Anish Mehta at Emory. We've gotten a lot of questions from our partners in community hospitals and critical access hospitals. And unfortunately, we can't have the adaptive clinical trial at every hospital, but I would encourage people to look at clinicaltrials.gov, contact the representatives for the studies that may be of interest to your centers, and try to get them onboarded there. There are multiple of these studies that are not as cumbersome as, say, the NIH adaptive clinical trial to onboard, and that will generate good data that will help us in the long run. So I would encourage people to try to find those studies if at all possible, and many of those have been launched at small community hospitals and critical access hospitals to date. So over.
Thank you. Administrator Vermeer, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And if there are additional questions, we'll open it back up to all the speakers. But we're going to move to the pulmonology and critical care treatment and therapy, and that's going to be led by Dr. Brian Stein, who's pulmonary critical care physician at Rush Hospital. And then we'll hear from Dr. Josh Bendit, medical director of respiratory services at the University of Washington Medical Center. Thank you. Dr. Stein, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today. My name is Dr. Brian Stein. I am a pulmonary critical care provider at Rush University Medical Center, also the Associate Chief Medical Officer for Hospital Operations, and I've been working fairly closely with our teams and our Incident Command Center to surge our capacity at Rush, as well as working on the various protocols that are both COVID-specific and not COVID-specific for our intensive care units. Rush is a tertiary care academic medical center in Chicago, and I was asked to speak on our experience, some best practices around managing COVID patients, and some specifics really around proning and tracheostomy. So our experience has been certainly a little more limited than the coasts, since the ramp-up really occurred mostly on the East Coast and the West Coast, but we are currently seeing our numbers increase rapidly. We are also a high-volume critical care transfer center, and so we've seen an influx of these patients as well, and currently have upwards of 70 patients in the hospital and 30 COVID patients on mechanical ventilators at this time. I think, again, I think we're a little different than the rest of the city of Chicago in the sense that we have a little bit of an enriched critical care population, but I anticipate everyone's going to be seeing more in the coming days to weeks. So, again, I was asked to speak on some of the best practices, and I think one thing to point out is that, well, COVID-19 is new. The disease we're seeing in the ICU is not. From a pulmonary and critical care perspective, we manage this all the time as a condition, and that condition being acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS, just typically not on this scale. And the kind of general recommendations for ARDS really apply to COVID-type ARDS as well, with a couple caveats. So, I think and I'll go through kind of the general recommendations initially around managing these patients in the ICU are if you have an ARDS patient with COVID, is to use the standard lung protective strategies, low pressure, low volume, typically a 6 cc's per kg tidal volume, and keeping the plateau pressure in the place where we typically like to keep it. Also recommended, and again, not isolated to COVID, are conservative fluid strategies. Now, one thing that did come out early is that these patients don't tend to respond or respond more poorly to increased fluid administration. And so when we're faced with patients with low blood pressure, we're actually giving less fluids than we have traditionally to this type of patient. So we're trying to enact an even more restrictive fluid strategy and go move to what we call vasoactive medications or vasopressors, blood medications to keep your blood pressure up earlier on than giving liters and liters of fluids, which we typically do in the setting of concurrent sepsis, which we do see with this disease as well. The other thing that has been noted, and again, there's not a lot of published literature on COVID patients. There's just, you know, case series sitting out there. I think we'll see a lot more of them coming to light. But they tend to like a higher back pressure or PEEP on the ventilator, and their lungs don't seem quite as stiff as we have seen in kind of typical ARDS. Other recommendations have been to avoid systemic steroids, and again, that I think can be kind of controversial in the pulmonary critical care world, but many people avoid steroids initially anyways for ARDS unless you're using it for a different indication, such as refractory shock or adrenal insufficiency in those circumstances. With regard to prone positioning, and that was one topic that I was asked to talk about, so prone positioning is taking a patient who's on a mechanical ventilator and flipping them onto their stomach and ventilating them basically on their stomach for an extended period of time. Benefits have been seen kind of in the population of doing it over at least for 12 hours when you're flipping someone. And again, prone positioning is not new either for us. It has been recommended by most critical care societies as part of routine severe ARDS management. And that's based on data from roughly 7 years ago demonstrating a mortality benefit, though there are those that still argue about that trial, given several prior negative trials that didn't show benefit in similar populations before that. So the question then comes down to, okay, if we are doing proning, why would it potentially be beneficial? And so we know that, again, from an outcome perspective, there's outcome data that demonstrate survival benefit, but we know that you improve your oxygen levels or you improve your oxygen requirements through multiple possible mechanisms when you take someone and flip them from their back to their stomach. As I mentioned, you know, there's a potential survival benefit in doing that, though there is no COVID-specific data around survival. There are some case series demonstrating perhaps some improved lung compliance in very small case series, but again, no COVID-specific data around proning. And again, this is endorsed by most critical care societies as kind of the standard around managing severe ARDS. So the question is, you know, why might it even be controversial if it's recommended? It improves survival, it improves oxygen saturation. And it's because it hasn't been widely adopted across the country for several reasons. So one, it's not risk-free. So when you flip someone onto their stomach, you can deal with the complications of potentially developing pressure wounds from having the areas of the body in contact with the bed or other medical devices over time. So you have to be very cautious with that. You can run into problems with blood pressure when turning patients, and we kind of would abort if that happens. Another concern is the loss of endotracheal tubes or the breathing tubes or the loss of IVs or central venous access or basically anything attached to the patient when you're trying to turn a patient. It's just a kind of a mechanical complication of turning someone with lots of lines and tubes attached to them. Another concern, again, is obstructing the actual breathing tube when you do that. So there is risk to doing it, but what has been demonstrated that if you have an experienced team doing it, that it can be done safely with no increase in complications. The other reason I think it hasn't been widely adopted kind of across the country is it's very labor intensive. It takes a team of six or more people to flip someone and keep all the lines and tubes intact. And that's maybe even six or more people at times. And if you think about, you know, a patient who might weigh 300 or 400 pounds, to turn them over on a mechanical ventilator with a team and not lose anything, not have a complication, is a really daunting task. And while the studies have demonstrated, you know, that there may not be any increased complications, all of the trials that have looked at this have had very experienced proning teams, or they were intensive care units with years of experience in doing this. So it wasn't like we went out to the community and said, okay, start proning people, and didn't have these sorts of complications. And so at Rush, what are we doing currently? So we are proning people. I think we haven't had this many ARDS patients on ventilators at the same time. And if you think about proning 30 people every 12 to 16 hours, or if you get up into 60 or even 100 people, that's a real daunting task to implement this kind of therapy. So what we're doing currently is developing or creating a team, basically, that's going to have to go around and do it, because it would occupy the entire ICU's team time to go from room to room otherwise and perform this procedure. So I think another important question still to answer is whether it's making a difference or not. I know we'll get a fair amount of observational data out of this, and that may help to answer the question. But it might be an important question to answer with the number of patients who we're going to see in current state in ARDS on ventilators. And then the other question is, can it be safely performed in the community? And I think that's a really difficult question to answer, and it really depends how many patients you have and what kind of support staff you have in a community hospital. And so I'll move on for tracheostomy. This is a work in progress even for us. I have a team that have kind of put together guidelines based on communications with China, with folks that they know there. And I haven't seen there may even be a guideline statement, but in current state, the last recommendation I saw was waiting till day 21 with two negative COVID tests. I'm not sure I would endorse that recommendation yet. I think it needs more discussion around, and again, if you're going to have to wait that long and they have negative testing on repeat testing, whether you need to even wait that long, or you could go earlier if need be. And then the last area I wanted to talk about a little bit was ECMO and extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is kind of salvage therapy for ARDS and done by only specialized centers, which are ECMO centers, which is for patients with kind of refractory ARDS. And there are, I think, cautionary tales out of China with respect to just go ahead and moving ahead with ECMO routinely with really high mortality rates in this population. However, if you have tight enough selection criteria, there still may be patients that we want to implement this modality on. Again, that's even for academic, tertiary, coronary care centers. It's very labor intensive from that perspective, and I think there's going to have to be more, some careful thought about who we are actually putting on ECMO as we move forward. And that's all I had, and so I'm happy to hand off to the next speaker and answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Stein. That was terrific. Dr. Bendit, do you want to go ahead and give your presentation, and then we can just open the line for questions for both speakers?
Great. Thank you. I'll go ahead and present now. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. Not only am I presenting, but I have learned a tremendous amount already. My name is Josh Bendit. I am a pulmonary critical care physician at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. I am the medical director for respiratory care services at our main academic center and work very closely with the other three medical directors at our other three hospitals. And what I'm going to talk about today, I think Dr. Stein has done a beautiful job talking about the direct critical care. I'm going to talk about some issues that we have been dealing with here with regards to respiratory care and ventilators, and which I think might be helpful for other places around the country. So the three areas I'm going to talk about is managing our ventilator supply here at the University of Washington. The second is managing the respiratory care practitioner personnel supply. And then the third is an idea that is being worked on right now about load sharing between hospitals in the Seattle area. We're a large and very growing metropolitan area, and there are a number of large private hospitals around, and we are working with them. So the first point, management of our own ventilator supply. So the first thing that I have done is an inventory of each of our hospitals in terms of the ventilators that we do have. And I was very surprised to find that we had ventilators in areas that you would not necessarily expect them to be. So, for instance, in our outpatient day surgery arenas, in outpatient clinics, they have anesthesia ventilators as well as some portable ventilators, and I did not realize that. We've got them into our database. We then spoke with our anesthesiologist about operating room ventilators, and this may be a topic about which there are questions that I'm happy to answer. We found that at my hospital alone, we had 60 OR anesthesia ventilators. And given that we have about 60 ICU ventilators available, we were able to double our ventilator supply almost immediately. We then, and I came up with this, about establishing what I am calling a conceptual tier categorization of the types of ventilators that we have. So for those of you in pulmonary critical care, this will be obvious to you, but for other folks, maybe not so much. We have standard ICU ventilators that most ICUs have. They've been designed for taking care of critically ill patients, and they have been treating people with ARDS as the COVID-19 patients are for decades. That is the major supply for us. However, there are other types of ventilators available. There are anesthesia OR ventilators, and the more modern devices have every capability of a standard ICU ventilator and can be moved out of the operating room. We have a large number of transport ventilators that we have brought into our database. They are generally used in transporting people either from outside hospitals to us or from OR to ICU, but they are capable of ventilating patients with ARDS. We then have a supply of home ventilators, these are ventilators that would be used at home by people with neuromuscular disease, tracheostomized patients, et cetera. Again, there may be questions on those as well. I'll tell you how we are using them. Lastly, we have many, many BiPAP and CPAP units, and we have a lot of calls trying to donate those to us. I'll tell you how we utilize those in a moment. So, in this kind of tier system as a conceptual framework, we are using our standard ICU ventilators for intubated patients with COVID-19, assuming that they are likely to develop ARDS, which is seen in many of these patients. We're also using it for other critically ill patients with ARDS, but we're trying to conserve those. We are going to be using our anesthesia OR ventilated patients for intubated COVID-19 negative patients. That is, somebody who comes out of the OR, needs ventilation for a day or two, we'll use it for them. Obviously, we have patients coming in with pneumonias, severe asthma. They will be used for them. We are going to need to train our respiratory therapists, and we've developed a one-page review sheet for the types of anesthesia ventilators that we have. Also, our anesthesia techs are helping out our respiratory therapists. Because we're doing less operations, they can come up to the ICU. The transport ventilators would be used next. We're using it generally for COVID-19 negative patient and also have negative testing. They are a little bit less solid than the other two types of ventilators. They're much smaller. They're a little bit harder to do exhalatory filtration on, meaning to not blow secretions into the room. Home ventilators, we are using those only for COVID-negative patients with negative testing. They also have some issues with filtering the exhalatory ports on the ventilator, so we're using them on patients who are not positive. The same thing with all the BiPAP units, and we hope not to ever need to use those. The difficulty with both the home ventilators and the BiPAP units, again, is that they don't have all the capabilities of the ICU ventilators, and they also are a little bit more difficult to make sure that the exhalation side of things is filtered with respect to the room. And if we end up having to treat COVID-19 positive patients with those lesser ventilators, we are going to make sure that the rooms and everyone going in to them use full PPE. And especially, there's been a lot of debate about using non-invasive ventilations for COVID patients. I've worked with non-invasive ventilation for many, many years, and although there's debate as to whether it is truly an aerosolizing procedure, I think at this moment in time, there's not enough data, and we really need to say that it probably is. So if you're going to treat people with a BiPAP or CPAP who have COVID, I would say you need to use full PPE. Split ventilation, meaning using one ventilator for multiple patients. Here we have decided we are not going to do that. For those of you who are physiologists out there, there are some real issues around two patients on one ventilator and who will get the lion's share of the ventilation. And we decided we are not going to do that. I know that has been in the news. We're not going to do it. Point two, the management of our respiratory care practitioner personnel. So the first thing that we have done, and I think most places have, is cancel all outpatient respiratory care activities. That means we've shut down our pulmonary function test lab, where we have about six respiratory care practitioners. We've cut out our respiratory care practitioners in any clinics, and we've taken our practitioners who are involved with home care and brought them in to the main hospital for surge capacity. My excellent manager for respiratory care has actually designed a three-level of RT assignments in the ICU depending on the surge numbers. I should mention we're predicted to have our surge here in Washington State somewhere in the second week of April. We don't know exactly, but our usual for a respiratory therapist is about 6 ventilated patients per therapist in the ICU. If the surge were mild, that's probably where we'd stay. If we have a moderate surge, we're going to have 12 to 14 ventilated patients per respiratory care practitioner. If we had a severe surge, there would be 20 ventilated patients per respiratory care practitioner. Obviously, that has loosened up our hospital policy, but, it is what it is. So far, thank goodness, we have not entered the surge, and we haven't had to go to those very high numbers per practitioner. The last point I wanted to make was about load sharing between hospitals. At our center, we have what's called an incident command center. I would guess many places have that. We have twice a day phone calls with the directors of the hospital and people from various departments. We know every day, twice a day, where all the COVID patients are in our system as well as the city of Seattle. And what we have done within our system is that we are doing load sharing. So if somebody is coming in to our emergency room and it looks definitely like they're going to have COVID, we will send them to the place that has the most capacity. We have actually transferred one or two patients who developed very severe disease from our community hospitals to the university center, and it's balancing the numbers of patients that we have. We obviously can't do that on an hour-by-hour basis, but we look at the trends. Then we are trying to develop a system for load sharing between all Seattle region hospitals. So we have a number of large private hospitals. We are speaking with them regularly, and what our hope is that if one hospital gets overwhelmed, we will bring patients over to other hospitals that are less busy. You may remember at the beginning of this, the Life Center nursing homes had this gigantic number of positive patients. They went to a small, relatively small community hospital who did a fabulous job with them. But basically, once they were full, we said all further COVID patients are coming to the main centers. So that's a lot of kind of information. I've tried to make it as practical in preparing for the numbers of patients that we see. I will stop there, and yes, we can entertain questions.
That was terrific, Dr. Bendit. Really appreciate it, and we'll probably have somebody follow up with you on your use of the ventilators. I thought that was very interesting, and I think something that a lot of folks could benefit from. With that, why don't we open it up to questions at this point? I know we're running out a little bit of time, but we're going to try to do these calls more frequently so that people have an opportunity to present more information and ask questions, but we'll just use our remaining time for the questions. And then I think there's a few words. I think we were going to talk about the rheumatology patients. So if we get time for that, that'd be great, or otherwise we may do that on our next call. Thank you. So, operator, if we can open it up for questions.
And we have a question from Sharon Keane. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. First of all, I'm about to become a frontline telehealth provider for a new app, COVID-MD. So all of this information is very helpful to knowing what's happening across the country. But I am also a friend and colleague of former Surgeon General Rich Carmona, and I queried him about the possibility of a topical approach to the COVID-19 infection, because we know, as a surgeon, we always look at things anatomically. We know that this virus goes in through the nose and the mouth. Has anyone looked at nasal sprays and throat gargling as a means to reduce viral burden? Because that is a cheap and easy way that we could add to hand washing to potentially reduce a patient's risk of infection and reduce somebody who is infected, reduce the transmissibility. And there have been two small studies that I know of that showed a reduced viral burden with these maneuvers. Has anyone studied this?
Is there anybody from FDA on the line that wants to take that question?
Let's see if Dr. Khalil is still there.
Oh, thanks for passing about. No, yeah, I'm not aware of. I think it's an interesting question. I think the, but to be honest with you, I mean, as you mentioned, there were very what we know even from from just regular pre-op, studies. We know very little. We have just not enough data to have a safety issue in terms of knowing, because if we're able to provide a solution that has antiviral capacity, even something that's not so irritating as alcoholic solution, but something that could reduce the amount of virus in either the nose or the mouth, I think it's biologically interesting, but the reality is it's that, and that alone wouldn't be enough for us to really provide you safety for the operating procedure, because besides reducing the load, you want to make sure that whatever is left in the upper airway is not going to be contagious to healthcare professionals and to other patients. So I think it's an interesting idea, but we've not seen the fruition of this either in the past or currently. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be looked at. I think it's an interesting idea, but I'm not aware of any data that could support us to moving forward, at least during the outbreak. I think it's something that can be studied, but I'm not aware of anything that can really change
us. There is data to support a reduced viral load. It's been studied for the common cold, which included coronavirus. They're small studies.
Correct, but the reduction.
And I agree with you. It would be dangerous to do in an operative setting, but for prophylaxis and for the general population, reducing viral load could conceivably reduce infection and maybe even symptom severity.
I think the theoretically you're absolutely right, but we also know that the viral load it's quite unreliable, especially in the upper airways. It's very hard to know the clinical significance of viral load. So I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate here, in the sense that I agree with you that that's a very interesting concept, that it should be evaluated. I'm not against, but I'm just saying that I'm a little skeptic about the viral load being predictive of things, because it's very much a consequence of the collection of the data, the type of FSA that you do. So there are a lot of variables that I have to account for. But I'm not agreeing with the concept. I think it's an interesting concept.
So who would I talk to about conceivably getting such a study done? Because just telling the public to wash their hands is a great idea. But if we could tell the public to also spray their nose and gargle and reduce the risk that asymptomatic carriers could spread their infection, this seems like a simple no-brainer if we know that it can reduce viral load.
Thank you. And we'll pass that on to the CDC as well. Okay, operator, can we go to the next question, please?
Thank you.
Yes, and the next question comes from the line of Joanna Biscrow. Your line is now open.
Yes, I do have a question. I am a family physician in Wisconsin, and I'm also a public health, I'm a local public health official. And so one of the things that all of us have been working so hard to get right is the dissemination of accurate information. I know he's not on the call, but I really want to tip my hat to our Surgeon General, who has been working day and night to make sure we get the accurate information out there. I guess my question is, from the more general standpoint, because a lot of the information that's come out has been confusing, especially with regard to treatments and what would work and what doesn't. I've heard so much information on this call regarding medications that we should not be doing. We've been trying so hard to get the right message out there I'm pleading for just better centralized guidance from the government to help us get the right message to the public. So what can we expect?
Thank you. That's a great suggestion, and we have a lot of government officials on the lines today, so that will certainly give us some things to do and task, and you're absolutely right, and we appreciate the advice. Can we go to our next question? Go ahead.
Hi, this is Debbie Bernkran. I'm aware that the Department of Health and Human Services is starting a treatment guidelines panel similar to the ones that they have for antiretroviral use and treatment of adults and children with HIV. So they're starting an HHS panel on COVID-19. So I think we all have to stay tuned for that.
I have a question.
Go ahead, please.
Me? Okay. I was curious I'm frontline primary care doing telehealth. I already did a lot of it. And so I have a lot of patients that are coming to me saying things like the loss of smell and taste. And I'm managing them at the house. They're not critical. They don't need to go to any place. But are you supposed to, one, be reporting these patients? Because in both Michigan and Ohio, none of them are able to be tested because they're not critical, and lack of testing things. But I also feel like the information would be needed for public health that, hey, we have these people that are sheltering in place with COVID-like symptoms, especially the agnosia and stuff. And so just curious on guidelines on that and if the whole loss of taste and smell truly is a real thing.
So what was the question of whether we should test them, test more people? This is Dr. Stein.
I'm in Ohio and Michigan. I'm on the border, so I work in the poorest parts of Detroit, and then also in Toledo, and I have a lot of patients that I'm having shelter in place, they're having COVID URI symptoms with it, but. The thing that makes me think they have COVID without any exposure is the loss of taste and smell that you keep hearing about in the news and different colleagues saying that this is COVID. I've talked to both health departments and they said, yeah, send them to these places to be tested. The patients call to get set up for testing and they're turned away because they are not considered a moderate or severe case and there's not enough testing. So am I supposed to be reporting these patients since we can't get testing? And then on top of that, is the whole loss of taste and smell truly something that has been found to be unique to COVID now? So it's like a double-sided question.
Well, I think that, again, I can't speak to the local testing, but I think that's an acceptable general recommendation is to really test your higher-risk patients and make the recommendations you are making to keep those who are lower risk and likely do have COVID infection at home from that perspective. And we know that'll be, you know, in any kind of epidemiologic measurement, we're typically not going to have data on those patients.
Thank you.
Okay,
we'll take our next question, please.
And your next question comes from the line of Dr. Karen Hart. Your line is now open.
Thank you so much for taking my question. I had just a couple things. One was related to the favipiravir. I do believe there's a Chinese study with 340 cases out there, so I did send some info to the FDA.gov address, so thank you so much for giving us a way to communicate. I'd like to get that to Dr. Khalil. I am in Westlake Village, California, I'm in Los Angeles County. One of the things I'm doing is, as a small private practice owner, is trying to help small practices adapt as quickly as we can to doing only essential care and to providing the ability to reduce the flow to ERs and urgent care. But what I'm finding, in the sense that things that we can take care of in the community, so the urgent care and ER can take care of respiratory diseases, but one of the things I'm finding is clinical practices are quite far behind, like 2 months maybe, two weeks or 4 weeks behind in how to deal with these things. So I'm still seeing practices taking people's temperatures or having staff go up to people's faces, test their temperature, check a travel history. You know, at this point, we are with the number of cases in the world and the number of countries, we're far along in that sense. So I was wondering if the FDA or CDC was planning to give some instruction to small practices so that we can avoid putting our staff right in the face of people who are presumed COVID positive. Additionally, when we're looking at 1% of people with asymptomatic people in Iceland testing positive for COVID-19 and 6% in the Netherlands, I presume that we should be instructing all practices to presume that every patient is positive if we're having any sort of in-person visits. So as we transition to telemedicine and work our way down in these inpatient visits and stick to urgent care, I just hope that we can remember the small practices that are trying to help help reduce the burden to the urgent facilities. So I'd love any commentary on that.
I have my practice in Downriver, Michigan, which is the poor part of Detroit that no one realizes or talks about. And we have a very big practice that's able to have a great triage center and help take the burden off ERs, but we can't get our access onto any PPE. So, like, we want to help be the front line, but if we can't get PPE, we can't help. And so that definitely limits. And then you also have other providers that aren't believing that this is real still and are still seeing patients and putting their staff at risk without PPE. So just getting that more out there. But I see what you're talking about with being far behind, because I've seen it in some of my colleagues.
Great. I think we just have a few more minutes here. We're a little bit over on time. Dr. Nikolov, do you want to make some just a few comments on the impact on rheumatology patients?
Sure. So I'll try to be brief because I know we're short on time. But first off, I would like to thank the organizers for recognizing this important topic and the opportunity to share some thoughts and considerations on how COVID-19 situation affects patients with rheumatologic conditions, but I would also include transplantations because some of the considerations are pertinent to that population as well. I'll start with the fact that the rheumatology and transplant patients are immunosuppressed for the most part due to either their disease or treatments of their disease. And by default, they're at higher risk for infections and potentially more serious disease and death related to COVID-19. Even though some of the published literature, albeit limited, suggests that they may fare similarly to the general population. On a different note, immunosuppressive and immunomodulatory therapies used in rheumatology and transplant patients have received significant attention as potential treatment options for patients with COVID. And as a result, these treatments are getting diverted to combat COVID-19 and are or may soon be no longer available to these patients. And this became apparent from the very first question that we received on this call today about the hydroxychloroquine shortage. Even as we consider the promise of some of these products, we must also remain cognizant of and responsive to the developments that could bring unintended consequences to other patients. As it was highlighted, we have seen a significant surge in demand for chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, which has had an impact on patients who are dependent on these treatments, like patients with systemic lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. And for systemic lupus, this is a cornerstone of treatment. As Dr. Shah has shared in his response to the question before, the shortage has been on the FDA's list to address, and FDA has been working and will continue to work with all the stakeholders to mitigate the shortage. In addition, a contingency medical treatment planning may be in order for patients, prescribers, and professional organizations to consider in this setting. And I just want to point the audience to the American College of Rheumatology that has issued guiding principles to scarce resource allocation during the COVID-19 pandemic, specifically talking about the case of hydroxychloroquine. There has been also some publicity on the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which are used by many of the rheumatologic patients, but also general population. And the FDA has also published an advisory on this topic, recognizing that there have been news reports stating the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen could worsen COVID-19. However, at this time, FDA is not aware of scientific evidence connecting the use of NSAIDs like ibuprofen with worsening of COVID-19 symptoms, and the agency continues to investigate this issue and will communicate if we have more information. There are also a few additional considerations that are not specific but are relevant to the rheumatology and the transplantations, and the first one is that we have to recognize the impact on routine medical care, which was already shared by many of the callers, where some healthcare services are now only performing emergency visits or procedures, and some healthcare services have shifted to virtual visits. COVID-19 epidemic has also impacted families' emotional, social, and financial well-being, and this is clearly a stressful time, and this has various impacts on families and health of patients and their families. And last but not least, COVID-19 has had an impact on clinical trial enrollment and participation, such as potential suspending enrollment, changes to study participation and assessments, and resources have been diverted to COVID-19 clinical programs. And to guide the considerations for the conduct of clinical trials, the FDA has proactively issued in the last week a guidance for industry investigators and institutional review boards on conduct of clinical trials of medical products during the COVID-19 epidemic. So, again, I promise to be brief, and with this I would like to thank you for the attention, and more importantly, to thank you for being in the front lines of managing our patients in these challenging times. We are humbled. Thank you.
Thank you. And why don't we just have a couple questions for Dr. Nicola? That was a great presentation. And then I know there are still probably more questions, and this is just the beginning of the discussions that we need to have around COVID. So we will be having more calls. And, you know, if you want to send questions in advance, we can try to make sure that we have speakers in line that can answer those questions. And I really do want to thank all the speakers today. I think you guys have done an amazing job today getting information out. Again, just echo everybody's sentiments about those of you that are working on the front lines, and appreciate the suggestions that we got from the government as well, and we will go to work on those. But let me just open it up for a couple more questions. Thank you.
Okay, and we have a question from Robin Dorr. Your line is now open.
Thank you very much. We already talked, I'm a rheumatologist. We already talked about the shortage of hydroxychloroquine. The other problem is because of using the IL-6 drugs to treat the cytokine storm, my patients have not been able to get their subcutaneous and intravenous Actemra. And my local hospital is actually taking the Actemra that they've ordered from their supplier and saving it for their COVID patients, so denying my rheumatoid patients access to therapy. So I wanted to make certain that the FDA was aware of this shortage as well. I've talked to the company, and they say they're not able to keep up with the demand. So if the FDA could also work on the Actemra in addition to hydroxychloroquine, I would really appreciate that.
This is Nikolai Nikolov. We certainly appreciate your comment, and I just want to assure you that this potential shortage is also on our radar. IL-6 targeted therapies have been some of these therapies that are considered for investigation and potentially on the shortage list and can impact particularly rheumatoid arthritis patients. But we are aware of this and we'll keep working on trying to address this.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much because my patients are now, I'm trying to go from infusion center to infusion center, trying to find a place for them to get treated so their RA doesn't flare terribly. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, and we heard about also pediatric patients who need Actemra for their disease, that there could be potential shortages for them too. So that's another consideration.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Michael Mantarino. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. Thank you for that presentation. It's very helpful. I'm a MedPeds physician in Pennsylvania. And again, we're not able to get testing kits and personal protective equipment. So I know you're going to work on that. I appreciate that. But what are your thoughts about pediatric patients? We didn't talk about that. And their parents as potentially, if we're assuming they're asymptomatic carriers, should we convert everyone over to virtual visits? And as you know, that can be difficult with newborns and infants. Thank you very much.
And your next question comes from the line of Juliet Brzezinski. Your line is now open.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead, please.
Hello? Oh, hi. Yeah, Juliet Brzezinski, Michigan. I have, and it kind of, there's some duplication with one of the previous callers, is the issue with universal masking for healthcare staff. There are some issues with critical access hospitals. A lot of the rural health regions, many of my colleagues and friends who work in healthcare and medicine are hearing a lot of backlash for wearing even standard masks in clinical settings. And I just wonder, will there be a mandate soon that will require that hospitals and clinical environments require everybody to wear at least a minimal standard surgical mask? In addition to that, obviously, higher level PPE when it's called for with direct patient care.
This is Arjun Srinivasan from CDC. Do you mind if I jump in on this one?
Please do.
It's an outstanding question. We already do have a recommendation for this healthcare worker masking as a universal healthcare worker masking as a source control strategy in nursing homes. And it's a great question. We are having discussions about moving that direction and issuing some recommendations on it in other types of settings. The biggest challenge, of course, is with PPE supply. We've been reluctant to make these types of recommendations because of the some of the supply limitations that we are hearing about and know about. However, we are hoping that as supplies begin to become more available, that these other types of uses of masks as source control could come into play. We think they could be helpful. So it's a great question, and I think more to come pending what happens with the supply chain issues.
Great. Thank you.
Well, again, I want to thank all the participants for joining us today. I think this is a great discussion. A lot of questions still out there that we'll try our best to make sure that those questions are try to get answered as much as we can. Also, we will be converting this discussion today into a podcast. So if there are some of your colleagues out there that didn't get a chance to participate in this, we'll make sure that that opportunity is available. We will be continuing these calls, and so would appreciate any suggestions you have on topics or speakers. And again, very thankful to our speakers. You guys all did a fantastic job. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes this conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect. Speakers, please stay on the line.